We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 90. I'm Chris Webster. Today's show is another presentation from the You Call This Archaeology Facebook Live Show, this time with a guest, Stuart Rathbone, who will talk about the transportation corridors over Donner Pass between Reno and Sacramento, California. Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the Archaeology Show. I believe this is episode 90. If you're hearing the audio recording of this, and I just want to put out right away, we are going to have a presentation a little bit later by our special guest today, and the slides for that presentation, since you're obviously not going to be seeing the things that we're seeing on the screen, are going to be in the show notes for this podcast at archpodnet.com/archaeology/90. There they are. So, hey, welcome to our first guest, I think, for the Archaeology Show.
Yeah.
Stuart Rathbone.
Cool. Oh, you mean you call this Archaeology? Because I feel like you have plenty of guests.
You call this Archaeology. Yeah, we're doing the live Facebook thing. So you call this Archaeology. First real guest, Stuart Rathbone. And also, I guess, your first guest for Twitch and YouTube channel, right?
Yeah. Cool.
Anyway, Stuart, how's it going, man?
Yeah.
It's good, mate. It's good. Keeping busy, which is nice. Surprising, I suppose.
Yeah, you're keeping busy from a work standpoint. Your CRM firm is still got to have you guys doing things?
Yeah, we haven't closed down at all, really. Everyone's working from home, and because of the work we've been working on, we're still getting covered by the essential worker category.
Ooh,
which is okay. Really an unusual position to be in. I've never been called essential before. I have a letter, Chris. It's a formal letter that says I'm essential.
Oh my. Ooh. Who determined you were essential? Is that from your company or like the governor?
The president of the firm.
Oh my.
Yeah. I know.
Well, there you go. I wasn't aware that individual companies could determine whether or not you were essential.
I'm not sure if it's legally binding. but it looks the part, you see.
Yeah.
No, well, it's because we do all that environmental remediation stuff, so that's the bit that's essential. Yeah. We're out in support of that. We cover that way. But yeah, we're ticking along.
Yeah.
Well, just for people listening to this in the future, I've been pointing out the last month or so, every podcast we record, what the date is that we're recording, because things are changing so quickly. So we're recording this on April 26th, 2020. So if the world has gone into apocalypse mode in a week or so when this comes out on the Archaeology Podcast Network, or if you happen to be watching it on one of Richie's resources in the future, then that's what's going on. Yeah, we are blissfully unaware of the future apocalypse that's going to happen, and we're in the current apocalypse of April 26th. So there it is.
God, you know,
I was thinking yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm a bit surprised with the, you know, I'm a big sci-fi fan, and apocalypse was all supposed to be, you know, Mad Max style, and we'd all be getting mohawks, and the costume was going to be very, you know, sci-fi bondage, gear, steampunk, that sort of thing. And it's turned out to be sweatpants.
Well, you know what's interesting? When this whole thing first started, I was still coming back from that project we were on, and there was someone talking about because he had been doing studies of all these preppers, and he was saying that the reason they don't believe that this is like the apocalypse is because all their apocalypse scenarios are basically all personal fantasies, and the example he's using was someone who said that the apocalypse was going to happen and there was going to be like an EMP pulse and all the technology was going to end. So he was stocking up bicycles and bicycle parts. So that way he can still get around. And so that's the reason why you see all these protesters, you see all these preppers, because they don't believe this is the end. Because right. It's all just a personal fantasy.
Which is pretty crazy, because this is the first incident in my lifetime where I've thought, you know, just because of the, I'm not a crazy doomsdayer. I'm not even really a conspiracy theorist. I don't get caught up in all that stuff. And yeah. I'm like, yeah, but we made a Costco order the other day and it got shipped yesterday. And I really considered that, should we get the 25 pound bag of flour? Because, you know, what if there's no flour in a couple months? We didn't, incidentally, but it was the first time I ever thought, yeah, but should we, you know, should we get the big bag of flour? Should we get the big bag of rice? Should we get some of the other like staples that aren't really going to go bad, just so we have it, you know?
Well, all the prepper materials, the dried, you know, the great big bags of dried beans that they've all been hoarding. Well, I'm still getting pizzas delivered, so, you know, good luck with that. Got a huge Chinese yesterday. It was fantastic, but good luck with those bags of beans.
Oh, my God. I went to Gold Mountain Ice Cream the other day, and I was talking to the owner. It's like, man, you know, I bet you wish you'd open a pizza parlor by now. And he was like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ice cream delivery is probably not so good of a thing right now.
No. Although, you know what I was surprised by? What was it? I tried the Raley's e-cart like yesterday. Mm-hmm. And it's only $6 to have them deliver it to your place as long as you're willing to order like about 4 days out, which isn't bad.
Not too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't like some stuff between the time I ordered it and the time that they dropped it off. Some stuff was already out because I think they only fulfill it on the day they ship out, which was really weird because it's like, then why do I have to order it so far out? But whatever.
So that's what we're thinking. Hey, it may be the apocalypse, but it's well catered and we're wearing comfortable clothes.
Hey, I'll tell you what. I was mentioning before we started going live here that I've been doing for the last day and a half, I've been doing a virtual search and rescue exercise with my Civil Air Patrol squadron, actually the whole entire Nevada wing. And it was actually really interesting and well run. We had up to 40 some odd people on a Zoom call at one time. And I ran a Zoom call for about 10 hours yesterday because I was the virtual base coordinator, basically making sure people had a place to come in, do briefings, things like that. But it was the most comfortable, we call it a SAR-X, search and rescue exercise. It was the most comfortable one I've ever done because I had my Civil Air Patrol shirt on and a pair of shorts. At one point, I had a nice drink with me as well, like I do now. I had an old fashioned. My wife bought the stuff. She's been into making old fashions lately. And I was like, it was fantastic. I didn't have to go into our headquarters, wear uncomfortable clothes and sit there all day in a building without heat or air conditioning. And I was like, this is fantastic. I don't want it to change. And it was some of the best training we've ever done. So there you go.
Wait, really?
Yeah, it really was because we had so many people involved. And a lot of times there's people that either just can't get away or can't get down to the mission base. And we often silo ourselves on these, what we call wing-led exercises, where each squadron is in its own place doing its own thing. And only a handful of people are really communicating at the squadron level, right? The wing level is communicating down to the squadron level, but the squadrons aren't really communicating because we don't have a really good efficient way to do that. And, but this time, with a single virtual meeting location, everybody was able to come in and really discuss everything in real time across the entire state. So, and I'm finding that with a lot of the different things I'm doing in this apocalypse time, with clients, with podcasts, with pretty much everything I'm doing. It's like people all of a sudden discovered video conferencing in the last month and a half, even though it's been around for a decade. You know,
yeah, I mean, but it was like, always it was always that cumbersome system where you had to dial in the right number and like everyone. Oh my God, it's just like a big mess.
Well, people figured it out real quick.
Oh my God.
So I just hope we don't lose this. You know, I hope we don't lose this. So
maybe.
Anyway.
You know, kind of like the way I don't think I want to go back to shopping in a grocery store because that was kind of scary yesterday, going to the grocery store, even with my mask.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I hear that.
So. Also, am I the only person who like color coordinated, like, you know, bought masks specifically to be, you know, color coordinated with their regular wardrobe?
Yes.
I don't think you are. Yeah. Well, maybe here on this call. Yeah. I definitely haven't. I have one N95 mask I've just been wearing, but I don't go out that often. So
I've never been able to figure out how to color coordinate between the clothes I'm wearing, Richie, let alone with accessories.
Good point. Good point. Hey, you know, before we go too far, too much farther, Stuart, why don't you just tell us a little about your background? Because you're recording from here in Reno, but you you don't sound like you're from Reno. I'm just going to put that out there. So what's your story?
Well, I'm a English guy. I've been in Reno for about 5 years now. I was an archaeologist over in England and Ireland for 15 years before coming here. Met a girl from the Midwest and she didn't like getting snowed on. So we ended up in Reno. It wasn't ever a long plan to move here, but it's done us well. We like it.
Yeah.
I enjoy not getting rained on and she enjoys not getting snowed on. So works out.
Well, that's pretty much Reno in a nutshell right there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Plus you must be enjoying your what is that, like a pool? Or is that more like a sauna in back or a hot tub?
The inflatable hot tub. That was my birthday present for last year. And it's a wonderful little thing, yeah. We've got a garden for the first time. We bought a house when I moved over and we bought, I don't know, it's 40 foot by 60 foot of Reno weeds and just dirt and spiky weeds. So it took us 4 years to sort that out. But we started that just after Christmas and
yeah,
we've landscaped the whole yard now. So it's lovely. And we're getting to stay at home to enjoy it. So.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
I feel like every time I go out biking, I see more and more people actually enjoying like their house or their apartment or whatever, as opposed to when I used to go out biking along the same routes before and no one was ever enjoying any of that.
I wouldn't want to be locked up in an apartment at the moment, but anyone with a bit of space must be loving it. Well, you must be glad that you're out of the downtown apartment and into a house now, aren't you?
Well, we're in a townhouse, so it's kind of an apartment. But we have a nice patio in the back here. All the townhouses are kind of in a, I guess, a square rectangle shape, for lack of a better way to say that, because it's not quite a rectangle. But in the back of our deck here, there's no like walking area. It's not like a courtyard with grass and stuff, so there's no people ever back there. It's just the other decks, I guess, but there's a big wall in between them, so you don't really actually see anyone. And there's a pond that has ducks and frogs in the evening, and so it's really nice and somewhat tranquil. And the room I'm sitting in right now, it's actually pretty cool, because the upstairs of this townhouse has two bedrooms, and the master bedroom is the one that has this kind of balcony that looks over that pond. And that's normally where people would put their bed and stuff. But we actually put our bed in the smaller bedroom on the other end because, I mean, what are you doing there besides sleep and store your clothes? You know what I mean? So we took the smaller bedroom for our actual bedroom, and the bigger room, we just call it the playroom, for lack of a better word. We've got another TV. My desk is up here now. We've got a couch. Our Peloton bike is right there. All my wife's knitting supplies. It's just kind of a nice little kind of second living room, really, a space that we can use for doing different things. And it looks out on the pond, and it's nice back here, nice and quiet. So it's not too bad.
I was just thinking this morning, we've got, you know, three bed house. So we've got the office in one, our bedroom in the other. And really, all we're doing with the other bedroom is storing a double bed in it.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to think, what's the point in that?
You know, my feeling on guest rooms is really, you know, unless you have guests a lot, and by a lot, I mean at least maybe like 7 to 10 times a year. If it's less than that, then I'm not going to keep a room for you all year long. Like, I'll even pay for your hotel room. It's probably cheaper for me and better for my sanity if I could just use that room for something else, you know?
Yeah.
Interesting. So, like, if I had a third bedroom, or I guess a second one, I'd probably just turn it into like studio space.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's a big enough room, but all it's just storing a bed and some clothes. So, I don't know. I haven't mentioned that to Christina yet.
Oh, my God. You know what the crazy thing is? I've been looking at campers and trailers online, and I've been seeing these converted toy haulers that people converted into, like, half a camper, half, like, a space for an ATV. And I was thinking, man, that'd be like, instead of putting an ATV there, that'd be like perfect studio space for like doing videos. you know, I just show up and like do a video and then wander around.
Nice. All right. Well, we're about 15 minutes into this on the recording side of things. So, Stuart, you were going to give us a little bit of a presentation while we're getting set up for that. What are you going to be talking about here for the next 20, 30 minutes?
So, this is a lecture I did earlier in the year up at the SHA conference, the Historical Archaeology Conference in Boston, which was a lot of fun. There was a whole day-long session on linear landscapes organized by David Mather, who's worked for the SHPO in Minnesota. Really nice guy. And I've been working on some sites up in Truckee on the Donner Pass and got very interested in the Transcontinental Railroad. And part of that was just in my own time. Some of it is to do with actual surveys and excavations we've been doing, but just understanding the whole story of that has become a bit of a hobby, and going out at the weekends and trying to find some of these sites that you're reading about. And it's just been a nice excuse to go and explore that area.
Ooh.
And there was a call for papers went out saying, oh, we're doing a seminar on linear landscapes. And I'm like, but I'm looking at a linear landscape. And so I did this presentation. So that's what it's going to be on. And I think with a lot of... I don't know how to turn off the notifications on my Facebook, but I have to say hello to Steve Quinn in Ireland, who's making some frequent requests in drum and bass music, because that's another thing that I do. So, hi, Steve.
Nice.
So, like a lot of presentations that I do, I think these call for papers are really good to kind of focus you on, you know, you're generally researching or thinking about a thing, and then you get an opportunity to develop it. And it's so, what I'm presenting is what I've been thinking about as I've been exploring that landscape. But there was a lot of something resembling stratigraphy up there.
Yeah.
And in that, I mean, there's all these linear features running through the valley and up over the pass. And they keep, you know, you'll see a bridge and it's crossing the river and it's crossing the railroad track. So that's sort of a horizontal relationship. And I sort of started playing around with the idea of how do you organize and map those relationships out. So that's what the talk is on.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I came up with something. It's kind of interesting, I think.
Why don't you bring up your slides and share your screen so people can see it? And while you're doing that, I'll mention again for the people listening to this on audio, the slides will be attached to this podcast. So archpodnet.com/archaeology/90. If I got that wrong, the episode number, I'm pretty sure I don't, but you can find it /archaeology. And that's just the page for the archaeology show. So we'll have the slides up there. And also, Stuart, perhaps you can tell people, unless it's in the beginning of your presentation here, because we get a lot of listeners to the audio feed that maybe aren't archaeologists. That's who the audience is designed for. So what is a linear landscape? Again, if you define that in the show, you don't need to go over it now, but what's a linear landscape?
I think that was one of the things they were trying to work out on the day. There's basically, you're looking at either a natural routeway or a river system, a pass through some mountains, railway lines, canals, anything that's going to have an arrangement of related sites along some, it's sort of a concept of travel and directionality running through some sort of linear feature. So I don't know that it's a particularly well-established term. And the presentations that day were on all sorts of things from aqueducts, long-distance aqueducts bringing waters to mills, canals in the Great Lakes, different railway lines, all sorts of stuff. So I think quite a broad term, but that definitely there's a directional aspect to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know, go ahead, Richie. Yeah.
I was going to say, interestingly enough, California actually has a form for that because I had the read through one, like all 20 pages of it or whatever.
Yep. That's right. And I will say, unlike a conference presentation, this is going to be a little bit different. So, you know, Stuart, you can just start giving your presentation. We'll flip through the slides here. Now that Richie's got the video formatted on the output here, I saw that happening. But if you've got any questions for Stuart, we're about 30 seconds behind on the Facebook feed. So we might get it to it a little late, but he can always pop back a slide and, We'll try to interrupt Stuart and get those questions in route, because why not? There's no need to save these all in towards the end. This is more of a conversational discussion, and Richie and I may ask him questions as well. So if you've got something you want to ask Stuart, just let us know in the comments. Let us know in the comments if you're watching this on Facebook at ArcPodNet. Facebook.com/ArcPodNet, because that's where I'm paying attention to it. If you're watching this on YouTube or Twitch, then Richie will see it there and he will present your comment forward.
Oh, yeah. I'm monitoring chat now.
Okay. Awesome. So everything's visible and working?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Looks good.
All right. Well, so the title of this, for those that aren't in the local area, Over the Hill seems to be a local euphemism. I'm not sure if it's on just in Reno or if it's the same in California or not, but it's this casual comment about driving across the Sierra Nevada mountains. What are you doing at the weekend? Oh, I'm driving over the hill. So we know what they mean, but it's a tremendous underestimate of what that journey actually involves. And I think that's the little joke behind that comment. So, I'm Stuart, and I work for, I'm looking up at these mountains. These snowy images you can see is where that becomes a bit brutal, because at any time in the winter, this area can dump 6 foot of snow overnight, no problem, and cause these horrendous conditions. And I suppose every winter, always some blizzard that catches a load of people out and they get stuck up there overnight. Okay, and PowerPoint just closed on me.
Oh.
So that's fun.
Yeah. You know, it's live. Hang on, let me get everything rearranged.
So yeah, you know, you're always told to take your chains and blankets and food as you're doing this journey that, which, in fairness, in modern conditions, should take about 2 hours, 2.5 hours now to get over them, unless it goes horribly wrong.
And that's these days, by the way, because I know that back in the old days, like when the Donner Party was actually going through, there wasn't really a real direct route. Like it was like a lot of crazy mountain climbing to get over.
Yeah, I mean, the engineering that's gone on to make that a simple modern route is probably what got me most interested in it. Coming from an outside area.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we'll talk about it in a bit, but these horrendous early journeys over there, and now either by rail or by car you can get over, or you just fly over them. And it's become a very easy journey, but as I say, it can still go horribly wrong.
Oh, yeah.
So there's...
Real quick, the slideshow's not up again. But while you're bringing in that up, Chuck Hutchison on Facebook here is asking if you're talking about the Hastings route we're going to, or if you know what that is.
Oh, wait, no, like the Hastings cutoff, right?
That's further out in the state, isn't it?
Yeah, that's closer to, I want to say closer to Ely.
Because
I know, because I think so, I was recording a site near there. Oh, hang on, let me, it's interesting trying to manage this and do...
So I think the Hastings cutoff is part of one of the routes that brings people into the Reno area or the Truckee Meadows area. On that dropping out of Idaho and coming diagonally across. Is my screen up and running now?
Oh yeah, it's running.
It is. Yep.
Okay.
Hang on, I just got to move myself around. There we go.
So this is what we're talking about is the Donner Trail, or the Donner Pass, the Donner route over the Sierras, which connects to various of the emigrant trails.
Ooh.
We're going from Reno to Sacramento. That's the bit that crosses the mountains, and it's the terminus at either end, essentially. I mean, obviously, it then continues from Reno, heading east, and ends up in Salt Lake or Idaho, and from Sacramento, you're going to go over west to San Francisco. But this is this chunk with mountains in the way. You can see here the elevation change. I mean, Reno's at quite a good elevation already, but we're talking about 2,500 feet in quite a short distance to get to Donner Pass, and then this long slope off back down into California. You see a nice profile of it and how much steeper the eastern front of the hills are.
Yeah.
Still steep dropping down into California, but nothing quite like the Reno side the whole eastern front. Weird thing is if you ever look at the topography of the rail route, it's reversed.
Oh.
So that from the summit to Reno, if you see at the left-hand side of that lower image, is much gentler. And that's the engineering, getting rid of that gradient. So it's reversed on that image. That took me a minute to figure out. I'm like, what? Wow. So this is heading west. You follow the Truckee River up into the hills as far as where the town of Truckee is now, and then the Truckee goes off to the south and runs out of Lake Tahoe, at Tahoe City. But from that junction there, you go past Donner Lake, and then you hit the Donner Pass and this just almost vertical wall of granite that shoots up 1,000 foot. And I mean, what Richie was talking about earlier of how difficult it was, these are bits where they're having to dismantle before all the work took place.
Whew.
So there's tons of stuff along this route, and I couldn't deal with all of it at the moment. So the eastern 40 miles of that 130 mile route over to Sacramento. And a lot of what's focused on the creation of the road and to some extent the roads, but there's not so much written on the settlement pattern that this route created and all the activities that happened along it. And whilst individual sites and individual areas have been written about, like when they're in terms of a system, the opening of the train line and it gets running and then the books end. So I wanted to see what effect this opening, this route had over a longer period. And this is a neat slide. This one's a NASA image. What I like on this is you can actually see this one from space. That row of lights running from Reno to Sacramento is all the little settlements and junctions of the freeway lit up at night. I don't know if that's important or not. I've just never had a study area that you can see from space, so I like it.
You know, it's interesting. Chuck Hutcherson mentions, was it 4 Washoe Acorn Routes from Volume 8 of the Indians of the United States. Is that like along the same route?
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, interesting. I'd look it up, but my keyboard makes a lot of noise. What I get for having a gaming keyboard.
I should confess, I'm not very good with the prehistoric and ethnohistoric periods. Since I've been here, I've been mostly focusing on historic archaeology. So my apologies, I can't answer that question.
Well, I feel like, at least for me anyway, I feel like a lot of people like historics more in Reno than prehistorics. I might be wrong.
A lot of mining.
I do know the, I mean, the route was in use because the first wagon trains were led to it when they were talking to, well, the chief that ends up being called Truckee. And he, they meet him in the Truckee Meadows and they say, we want to get to, you know, over these hills. And he takes them up the route. He takes them up the, or he describes the way up the Truckee Canyon. So it's certainly a route that was known about.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Oh, interesting. God, they've got a similar kind of rail kind of thing near the Hastings Cutoff, actually. Or, yeah.
Yeah. That's the, is that the Markers to the West Foundation? Those ones are all part of. There's a really strange thing. A lot of this is the historical stuff to do with these routes is done by enthusiasts and local history groups. And there seems to be quite a history of competition between them and about accurately locating these routes. And some of the books can be quite aggressively written, dismissing other people's ideas and stuff. And of course, these, apart from a geographic constrictions, these trails were never they're not like roads, you know, they're not every wagon following one set of cartwheels across open areas. So those things are pretty neat.
Interesting. What's the wagon wheel?
That's at the old Reno Airport site, the old airmail station, which is now a country club or a municipal park or something.
Really?
So that's to the pioneers. Yeah, there's three monuments in a row. I might have another slide showing you the rest of them. It's not far from where I am.
Oh, really?
Is it on Arlington or something? Yeah.
Oh, wait a second. Interesting. Huh. Oh, wait, I think I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God! No, that's the thing I keep driving by and never stopping to look at.
Well, shame on you, Richie.
I know. Well, it's just like the videos I'm doing now. Like they're all around. They're all about historical sites here in Midtown, and I'm like, wow! I didn't realize so many interesting things happened here.
Yeah.
Or that this was actually the edge of town at one point.
Of course.
Cool. Interesting. Haha.
You there, lads?
Yep, we're here.
Oh, yeah, we're still here. Cool.
I think Stuart's having some connectivity issues a little bit.
I don't know.
Me. Well, I mean, yeah, but, you know, it happens.
Hey, Stuart, you can shut your video off. It might help your presentation go through. Just while we're doing this part, and then we'll turn your video back on when we're done with that.
Okay.
I can stop your video too. I'll go ahead and do that.
Okay. Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, wow. That cut the latency a lot, actually. Cool.
Yeah. He's running two streams, basically, with his video and his PowerPoint. So
Oh,
we'll just cut him off for a second. And if it gets, if it's still bad, then we'll cut mine off too. But I don't know what people would do on this feed if they couldn't see my video. It's really the only reason they're here. So, you know. All right. So if you get your PowerPoint frozen back up and running. Are you?
Mm-hmm. I'm trying.
Okay.
I'm going to reboot.
Nice. Well, let's, so I think this is, I think this is pretty interesting. There's been a, I heard this, what was it? It was a while back when I heard there was an author. I talked to him just a little bit because they were doing a book signing somewhere. I happened to be walking by, and it was somebody that wrote a book about the Donner Party and the trip across Donner Pass. And, you know, while I know the basics, I, of course, like most stories, you don't really know the full story unless you really read an in-depth history about it.
Yeah.
But even so, man, just Stuart, you're right. Right in the beginning when you were talking about this, it is amazing when you don't just put your blinders on and you cross that interstate and you just go over from Reno to Sacramento. Sometimes that journey, if you do it enough, can just be routine. And you're just like,
yeah,
you know, Richie, you go to the Bay Area all the time. You've probably been over the hill, I mean, hundreds of times. And
oh, yeah.
It's like, but when you really open your eyes and you look at it and you think, how in the hell did people do this? Like before there were highways, like what route could they possibly have taken? How did they even make it? You know, it's just, it's phenomenal to think when you're coming across the Reno, Truckee Meadows area and you've just come across what you didn't realize was the only state in the future United States that has the most named mountain ranges. One of the things in our search and rescue training we were doing this weekend, somebody said Nevada has over 500 named mountain ranges and many more unnamed mountain ranges. And it's more than any state in the union, including Alaska. And,
wow.
And you've just come over all those, but none of that was anything in comparison to what you're looking at facing the Sierra Nevadas. And I don't care where you're at, like anywhere along basically the Nevada side of the Sierra Nevadas, you're just looking at this wall of treachery and death. And usually it's real nice where you're standing on the east side. It looks great. The weather's beautiful. Yeah. And you can just see the cloudy, stormy rockiness of that eastern front, that eastern face of the Sierra Nevadas.
Well, it's not only that, but also
over it.
Oh, well, it's not only that, but it's also the fact that that's what got the Donner Party, because they came from the East Coast and they assumed they had seen winter. But winter in the Sierras is insane. Like, so much more insane than anything you'd ever see in the worst blizzard in New York, especially if you're actually trying to get over the mountain and down the other side before you die.
Right.
Oh, perfect. Looks like you got your slideshow going again.
No, I've just seen a spinny wheel.
Oh, wait, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Because
and I can't even close the program. Oh, you can.
Oh yeah, I mean we're seeing the whole PowerPoint interface, but yeah, your presentation is going, and now it just went dead. There we go.
Okay, right.
Oh, hang on, let me.
Stuart, while you're getting that up and running, let me share something on my screen real quick, because Chuck Hutchison sent over an image of what he was talking about, and here it is. These are the acorn routes for the Washoe that I think he was talking about. And, you know, it literally means going to get acorns, you know? I mean, from living on the shores of Lake Tahoe, it looks like, and then branching out across the Sierras and really following the rivers, it looks like. This is a pretty cool image. I'll try to zoom in a little bit here.
Cool.
Yeah. Oops, that's not working. There we go. So this is Lake Tahoe, which means there's Reno area right there.
Yeah.
And then looking at, so it's not quite following what these acorn routes are, because let's see, there's the Yuba River, there's the Truckee, and Little Donner Lake right there. So, you know, this would have been Interstate 80 coming across here. Because here's the Truckee River coming out and the 80 follows that. So it would have followed right up along this way. But anyway, yeah, that's a pretty cool little map here, showing these different routes where they would go for supplies, especially acorns.
Markleyville.
Yeah, said no one ever. So there you go.
Oh, I just think about that because of Topaz Lake. Because, you know, every time I go down 395, there's always that turn off there.
Yeah. Actually, the drive up past Markleyville is pretty good. It's pretty nice.
Yeah. I like it.
All right. I'll stop my share here.
Oh, whoops.
Thanks. Thanks, Chuck, for that. That was pretty cool.
Uh-oh. Hang on. See.
You know,
there we go.
Yeah, Amy's saying that's crazy. That's a lot of mountains. Yeah, it's pretty intense when you first come to Nevada. Not only just drive through it, but there are. It is intense. It really is intense. And then Eliza's asking, was the Donner Party the only travel train that got stuck there?
Well, they were the most famous, at least.
Well, yeah, and I think, I mean, they had some high-profile people on there. They had a lot of diary accounts, and of course, there was the cannibalism, which is how they really got famous. So I doubt they were the only party to get stuck in the wintertime going over the pass, but they might be the only ones that
I think ate each other.
Yeah.
I think that there are different routes crossing this thing, and the Donner Trail. And it's a reform, and it's too tough, and they just find better ways of getting across. And as it becomes more, they're only the second party to try it. So as they open up different routes to the north and to the south, and this thing, you know, after 3 years, 4 years, it's really dead. And of course, after what's happened, people are much more cautious about when they attempt the journey.
I can imagine.
Interesting.
So, Stuart, if your PowerPoint's going to keep on freezing up, maybe you can just discuss some of the things that you talked about in your presentation.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you get this pattern, and you've got the Stevens Townsend Murphy party, I think it is, are the first people across. And that opens up this journey from the Midwest into California. The Donner Party, as we've been talking about, follow them the next year. And what they're doing at that time, they're going straight up the Truckee Canyon. And the lower canyon is just awful. And it doesn't look it. It's one of the most, you know, that whole drive is so spectacular. And now you're on this sort of elevated, heavily engineered road. And you don't really see into the bottom of the canyon. But once you, if you look at the topography, it's weird. The lower part of the canyon is much steeper sided, and it's just this V-shaped gouge where the river is cut through. Whereas once you get about halfway up, it opens up and it's much broader and easier going. So that bottom of the canyon was just a nightmare because it's just rocks and this river. So the first thing, the next year, they open up the Dog Valley Canyon, which is the cutoff at Verde, and it loops up to the north and brings you into the middle part of the journey. So they stop that. That's a lot easier going. And then there's a series of alternate routes are made at the Donner Pass to avoid that. So you get Roller Pass opened up. There's another one to the south there. But then they just abandon it altogether and start using the Carson route, which is, 20, 30 miles to the south. And then you get other routes opening up to the north as well. So this thing becomes kind of an abandoned route. And it doesn't come back to any prominence until the railroad goes through. And it's scouted out by Theodore Judah in the early 1860s. He's not one of the big four names that are associated with the Transcontinental Railroad. The people that made all the money from it. He was the engineer who envisioned the project in the first place and got all the... He really worked himself to death to create this route. He's a very interesting guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was shown by one of the loggers he knew in the California side this particular route. And the reason they chose it is it's the only way through with only one summit. So as awful as it is for wagon trains, they don't need to do two full sets of tunnels. And that's why it's selected. So...
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's only a single peak. That's why they picked it for the railroad. And so then they finally locked down this route, and there's been this big national debate about where the train would go. They select this one. So then the Dutch Flat to Donner Lake wagon road is created, and that is an engineered construction road that's going to allow them to create the railroad. But that in itself is tremendously successful because it's a toll road. And they make a bloody fortune because they make it and then everyone wants to use it.
Yeah.
Because it's substantially easier. So, you know, the Carson Pass is opened up in 1848. The Beckworth Pass is in 1851. Around 1862, I think, 1863, the Dutch Flat Donner Lake Wagon Road is opened up, and that starts bringing people back after a sort of 10 or 12 year absence.
Yeah.
And then they build the railroad, they complete that. 1868, that's opened. Oh, Dutch Flat, that wagon road is 1861.
Yeah.
That brings a lot of people back into the area. And at the same time, Truckee Meadows and the Reno side is developing into more of it's not Reno yet, but they're digging all these agricultural ditches and starting to drain the water off of divert the water off of the Truckee to increase the agricultural potential on the eastern front. So that's all going on. When the railroad opens up, I mean, it's an instant and massive success. And it's involved so much, so many tunnels and bridges and fills and this horrendous death toll to create it, particularly given the Chinese labor force the hardest jobs to do because no one else would do them. So, you know, it's got its dark side, but just as a feat of engineering, it is absolutely magnificent. And that changes things. One of the things that does is it allows Reno to develop. I'm guessing, I would suggest strongly that there was always going to be a major settlement at some point along the eastern front of the Sierra.
Yeah, well, you need a break before you go over the other side anyway.
Yeah. And whatever, you know, but it could have been Minden, it could have been Gardnerville, it could have been Carson, it could have been further up.
Yeah, but all those towns suck.
Well, they stopped because they didn't get the railroad. And that railroad coming, that's why you can see this thing from space. It locks down the settlement pattern in the northern half of the state. We become the destination and the gate through to the through to California. And it's a weird thing locally that Reno doesn't seem to identify itself strongly as a transport town, but that's the only reason it's here. Everyone says, the divorce industry and the casinos and all of that. Yeah. The reason Reno thrived is because the railway was picked there. I mean, Sparks was created to service the railroad, and that's the third or fourth biggest town in the whole state, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So this thing is massively important for what happens, and it has a huge impact on the settlement pattern in California as well. Everything feeds off of the Central Pacific, and it's not so important anymore, but it's still a major freight route. So anyway, that's bringing people in. It creates the town of Truckee, and a lot of the other settlements are all dating from this town, but you get this long period of activity now. They start controlling the river, so the Tahoe Dam is first constructed in 1870. You get the first power station. I think this is fascinating, but Truckee gets a hydroelectric power station in 1888. Then you get a series of four more power stations in the canyon, so at Farad, Washoe, Fleisch, and the Sierra Pacific One, which is at Mogul. Those are built between 1901 and 1911. 1913, they remake the Tahoe Dam, which is the one that's there now. If anyone ever gets to see the robot that operates the dam there, it's very cool. They have, I think it's 7 gates or 13 gates. It used to be manually operated. They made this custom machine that goes along and still operates the manual gates, but now it's a little robot running on tracks. Very neat.
Oh, cool.
Wow. Yeah, well worth a look. Then 1913, the Lincoln Highway goes through the gap. Of course, again, once this thing is established, everything is going to follow it. Now, the Lincoln Highway, major event in the nation's history.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, it didn't involve hardly any construction. It's just a system of signposts and way stations. There's a little, very localized bits of road improvement, but it's not like a highway construction.
Oh, that's true. I mean, I've definitely been up and down some, like, you know, backcountry sections of it near Eureka. Or was it Ely? Well, whatever.
And yeah, well, if you've ever seen the old guidebooks, it's just a list of places to turn left or turn right.
Yeah.
You know, you get to this corner of the John's Field, turn left. drive for 10 miles. See that red house on the right? That's it. Swing a right there. You know, that's what the Lincoln Highway guides are like. And then they're telling you, oh, you can stop there and get a beer. 1915, the transcontinental telephone line goes through there. The transcontinental telegraph was moved there. It originally followed the Carson route, but it was moved to the Central Pacific at the time of its construction. And that was actually part of the bill that was passed to create it. It was saying, oh, and we're going to run the telegraph through. But the telephone goes through there and you get that, I forget now, I think it's Alexander Bell talking to the mayor of San Francisco through there. And the Transcontinental Airway follows it. So the famous concrete beacon arrows with the rotating beacons on them, they're going to follow the route. 1922, the Victory Highway goes through there, and that's when you start getting proper road construction. And there's a fantastic bridge up at Donner Pass that dates from that, the Rainbow Bridge up there. Well worth a look.
Yeah.
We talk about the CPR, and I mentioned this earlier, that all the books stop at the end of the construction in 68, 69, when it's open and running and all the books stop. But that's really unrealistic. The Central Pacific are bought out by the Union Pacific in 1901 and begin double tracking, which takes them 25 years to complete. So a whole nother set of tunnels and bridges are blasted through. So the total number of major bits of engineering up there is you know, doubled over this period. And it was that investment, because the big four that had run it really didn't invest in it once it had been created. That's an interesting story in itself. And I think when road transport really took off, I don't think the railway would have survived if the Union Pacific hadn't have already invested so much time and money in updating it. I don't think it would have lasted. So I can't remember the guy's name, but there was one particular guy in charge of doing that, and it kind of a visionary fella, because that's why we've still got this resource now. I genuinely believe that. It is now, I think in the 80s, it went back to a single track for large stretches, but it just wouldn't have survived the middle of the 20th century. So the Victory Highway goes in, and then 1926, the US 40, which is like an upgrade to Victory Highway, that goes through there. 64, I-80 goes in on a slightly different route. I mean, the same linear landscape thing, but it's, whereas Victory Highway and US 40 kind of follow the line of the Lincoln Highway, I-80 is a bigger thing, and it involves, again, all this suspended roads and, again, stunning bits of construction.
Oh yeah.
I think I read somewhere that the time to get the I-80 up Donner Pass, the length of the construction was the same as it took the railroad people 100 years earlier, because it's that bloody difficult. And all of this stuff is leaving buildings and great big bits of engineering. You've got all the wooden snow sheds, if anyone knows about those, but there was so much snowfall in the winter, they covered a lot of the track at the High Sierra with wooden snow sheds. They were running steam trains, so they just kept burning down. They kept having to rebuild them. Eventually, they were replaced with concrete things, and you still see those now. And then, because of the opening up of the area, you get the early tourism. The economy up there, up until 1900, was really about logging, and they depleted the forest quite heavily by that stage. There's a lot of failed mining in the area. They never did hit big. They formed up several mining districts. But in 1900, there's a real push to open up Truckee and Tahoe for tourism. So you've got all these early hotels up there still standing. There's some of them have been converted into really fabulous old people's condominium complexes and stuff. Some of them are still running as hotels. So it's just this tremendous amount of stuff.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
John Flood is watching us on Facebook here, and he's got a couple comments. I'm going to roll back to Donner Pass real quick because he had a pretty funny one here. He said I'd be mad if my party got stuck and we had to cannibalize each other, only to find out the pass was already named. Like, right? And then he mentioned referring to the railroad going across Nevada. He said double tracking has to be hard getting supplies out while regular trains are trying to run east-west, arguably as tough as the original laying of track. I can't even imagine that, especially in that area.
And when they did the double track, I forget which way they wanted to run the trains, but once they'd completed it, they found they hadn't got the grades right. So they had to change, and the trains actually ran in the opposite direction to what had been intended.
Oh,
right.
But they did run, crucially. Yeah. There's a little aside with these different organizations. The Stevens Townsend Murphy Party are the ones that first made the crossing. And E. Clampus Vitae, have I got that right, Chris?
Oh, E. Clampus Vitus. Yeah, the Clampers.
Vitus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're the sort of historical mining drinking club or whatever they are. They started a campaign at some point to have the name changed back to, so it's supposed to be the Donner Party, or the Donner Pass. It was going to be the Stevens Murphy Townsend Party. And you can see some of the monuments they put up at the pass up by Rainbow Bridge.
Yeah.
So you can see this. I don't know. These don't seem to be good things to argue about. But
yeah, well, unless you're like drinking a lot of beer.
I don't want to get in a fight with the Clampers, so let them have that.
Nice.
One of the interesting things about the roads is they start cutting off and isolating areas, in particular US 40 and then I-80. It's brutal. If you ever try and get off the main road up there, you find this network, the whole canyon is really inaccessible because the roads have been cut through and they just don't get anywhere. Yeah. And there's all these dead ends and then roads that have returned to sort of private ownership, so you're not allowed on them anymore. And that's created some archaeology of its own. So there's different bits of these long stretches of asphalt road that don't have a start or a beginning, particularly in the middle of the canyon. And there's some fantastic, I wouldn't say fantastic, there are some very extensive, what appear to be illegal dumping areas, which you could, I've got some photos of those, and the size of them is pretty impressive. It's not like can scatters. These are whole houses seem to have been demolished and pushed over the edge of these roads.
Jeez. Cool.
Well,
you know, cool to me at least.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as far as littering goes, it's pretty spectacular.
Well, you know, gives us job security.
Good luck recording those. And there's a tremendous amount of bridges which to do with the railroad and the roads, which are historical sites in their own right now because they're old enough. And mm-hmm. you know, that I haven't really looked at because it's a big enough issue that would take a lot of time. But trying to map out and understand all this stuff. Now I'm gonna have to try and get back to sharing this video.
All right.
Because the rest of this isn't gonna make sense.
Yeah,
if you get your PowerPoint up, go ahead and shut your camera off. But while Stuart is doing that, there have been a number of people joining the call. Thanks for everybody on the Facebook side of things where I can see. John just left another comment. He said, were all the Western railroads built on standard gauge track? He said, I know that during the American Civil War, the North and South were laying different gauge. North laid the same, while the South had a hodgepodge. However, post-war, was everything going west standard gauge? Do you know anything about the railroad tracks out here?
These big lines were standard gauge. The logging stuff. So there's there's narrow gauge out to the mines, and there's narrow gauge out to the logging camps. And the mm-hmm. bigger mines, things like the Tonopah Goldfield Railroad get upgraded to standard gauge. Because this had to connect to Ogden and wherever, so it very much did. It was an extension of the existing Eastern Railroad network.
Okay.
Interesting.
No, is my PowerPoint visible yet?
Not yet.
Just a black screen right now.
Yeah.
You are sharing, but it's not the PowerPoint.
Although it is interesting. I mean, the railroad did bring a whole bunch of standardization, so I don't see why you wouldn't have standard gauges the whole way across. Like, I know railroads are the reason we have time zones.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, you can't do it, but these if you've ever seen the logging trains, I forget what they're called now, but they're quite different. You should look them up. They have a completely different arrangement of wheels because the logging railroads were so short-lived that these things were just very quickly and simply laid, and they weren't graded in the same way that a main train would be. And the trains are designed that they can derail and be put back on the rails very quickly. So, you know, for functional reasons, they're quite different.
Oh, it's kind of like the reason why all the mining carts, you know, here in Nevada, I know it was super popular to just lay like strips of metal right over planks of wood or... I don't know, which is all like blocks of wood. And that's why you hardly ever find tracks out here.
Yeah, and the logging roads are really crude like that as well.
Yeah. Ha. Oh, hang on. Oh, good. Looks like you're getting it back.
You got something?
Well, no, but still.
It's just not having it.
Maybe. Oh,
dear.
Yeah. See, this is why you should have gone with Apple.
Well.
Oh, I did.
Well, you know, Stuart, this is we're approaching an hour for this show anyway. So, let's talk about some of your. I mean, what were some of the conclusions of your research? What are some of the things that you learned by doing this?
Well, so the point of the presentation and what you should be seeing now is what the question I was asking for this one was. Okay, you've got. And I hope I've given some impression of the density. Of the amount of historic sites that are up there. And what do you do with that information? How do you make it usable? So the first thing people are going to say these days is, oh, well, use GIS. Well, GIS, have you ever noticed that GIS people are just think that GIS is the answer to everything?
Of course.
And sometimes it's not. And the problem is, you've got something that's 130 miles long. So at any sensible scale that you map that, you're going to have meters and meters of a linear map. And you can't shrink it down, because as you shrink it down, you can't see the detail.
Of course.
And just putting it in a digital version doesn't actually overcome that problem. But with a linear landscape, if you're looking at the patterning and the relationships between things, you don't need to maintain that east to west or the horizontal axis. So you can squish all this stuff together because there's lots of blank spaces between things, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to think of a way of processing this information. And one of the things probably more common in archaeology back in Europe is the Harris matrix. Harris matrix is a schematic drawing of your stratigraphic relationships.
Oh, hang on.
We use that for doing big urban excavations typically, or that's where they're most useful. So I got onto one of the British
archaeology stratigraphy, basically.
Yeah. And I say that there are all these relationships. They don't behave themselves particularly, because sometimes the road is above the rail and sometimes it's under it, and depending on the topography. And
yeah.
But there is this linkage. So that's what I got thinking about. And I went on the Badger Forum, British Archaeological Jobs Resource, which is just very knowledgeable archaeologists hang out. And I asked this question, has anybody ever used a stratigraphic matrix for something as big as this? And the consensus was, that's quite interesting, but it wouldn't work. Okay. And a guy, Chiz Harwood, I think, got hold of me. And provided some very useful information, which was about land use diagrams. And he was I don't think he's in London anymore, but he was in London in the 90s. And they produced these, what they were calling land use diagrams, which are a simplified, not exactly, they're not recording stratigraphy, they're recording a plot of land over time and mapping out the different, like if there's a building there for this time span, and then it becomes a yard area, and then it becomes a garden, and then it becomes a building again. And so they're plotting out this sort of relationship between things in a schematic way. And that's exactly what I'd been struggling to do. So that was the key to it. And eventually I produced this wonderfully colored diagram that you can't see.
Oh, let's see.
Hey, Richie, I sent you the PDF of this the other day. Can you try and...
Oh, yeah, hang on. Let's see.
Just get that PDF of that diagram.
While Richie's doing that in the Facebook chat for this live show, and if I remember, I'll put it in the show notes, although I probably won't, so just listen to this. But we interviewed Edward Harris, the inventor of the Harris Matrix, at the Vancouver SAAs a few years ago, episode 13 of the Archaeology Show. And I put that link in the chat here. It's just archpodnet.com/archaeology/13. He was a great guy to interview and very humble about the Harris Matrix and having it named after him. Yeah.
I mean, it's a great tool. And that's what I was trying to work up was a tool that would answer this problem.
Hang on.
All right, Richie's got to do some configuration there.
Oh, yeah. Hang on.
Well, the weird thing is I'm not seeing the presentation over here, but I'm seeing our... Oh, Richie, you're sharing it on a different way. I gotcha.
Yep.
Yeah. Just make your face smaller.
Don't worry. It's away.
Okay. There we go. So, Stuart, if you're following along in Facebook, you can see it because he's not sharing it through Zoom, but he's putting it up on the display.
Okay, so I'll assume someone somewhere can see this. So what we've got here is a schematic representation of that first 40 miles from Reno up as far as Troy. And you can see down the... So there is no scale from left to right here. None of that size matters. But vertically, everything is by year. And you can see the different sorts of activity. So the red things are all the airmail route functions. The pink things are to do with tourism. The dark green is all the hydroelectric stuff. But what's also happening is you can see some thin horizontal lines going across, mostly mm-hmm. black. There's a couple of green ones and red ones.
Yeah.
So those are the longer linear features. So down the bottom, you've got the original Donner Pass route, and then the next year, the Dog Valley route opening up, and you can see where the original route diverges from the Dog Valley route. Above that, you see where the Dutch Flat Wagon Road goes in. Above that, you can go see where the Central Pacific goes through. And you can see the Central Pacific, how key it is, because almost all the activity starts immediately after that railroad is built. You can see all those other buildings and facilities have come in 1869, essentially, or 1868. And then going up, you get the different highways going through. Well, you see where US 40 goes in about 1926. You see all those light green bars are stopping. So that's all the lumber companies and the ice companies closing. I don't know what the relationship is between US 40 being built. Why did that lead to the closure of the ice companies and so many of the mills? Yeah. But the relationship is pretty clear. And above that, you can see where the canyon is really emptied out. There's very little in the middle Truckee Canyon now, where it used to have all those things. And that's either side of US 40. If you look,
interesting.
They always say, well, it burnt down in 1926 and they didn't bother rebuilding it and blame it closing on the fire. But it's a western town. In fact, Verdot's hit by a big fire that year. But it's a western town. Western towns always burn down.
Of course. Like, and they're always down rebuilt. A few times.
But Verdot doesn't particularly recover from that fire. Yeah. I mean, there's a great quote about Truckee being a long fire interspersed with periods of building. So this is what the diagram is doing. It's bringing out some patterning. When Interstate 80 goes through, that kills off the rail, the airmail route. You can see it lasts like 3 years longer.
Ah.
And maybe that's not a direct relationship there, but it's interesting. So that's what this thing is doing on a single page. It's showing you 40 mm-hmm. miles of relationships, and you can see some patterning in there. So I think it's a proving to be a really useful tool to examine this in an abstracted way, but in a useful way. And the plan is just as a hobby, just to keep plugging away at this, filling in more and more detail, finding more of the sites, and seeing what picture can be built up. There's you might see, if you look at the yellow line that's called Boca, underneath that it says Construction Camp 17.
Yeah.
And underneath Iceland it says Construction Camp 20. So those are a whole series of construction camps for the railroad that I suspect are underlying almost all of the other activity, because they're developing specific areas for half a year of occupation. And that involves creating some access routes, clearing away some of the boulders and the rocks. And then they're abandoned because they've finished building. Well, where are you going to build your ice company? On top of one of those construction camps. Where are you going to build your the next train depot? Oh, well, we've already got this prepared area. So there's lots of linkages between these things. And one of the things that the diagram is doing, for me anyways, telling me where I've got holes. Down in the bottom left, past Truckee, all that gap, up until the 1920s, that's filled with lumber mills, but I haven't found the locations yet.
Oh.
Hmm.
Whereas the gap in the middle at the top of the diagram is a real gap. So I think that was for my presentation, essentially. It's a useful tool for mapping out one of these linear resources, looking at the patterning, finding where you've got holes in the information,
That's much more useful than some of the linear records, some of the linear feature records I've read.
yeah, thank you. And again, imagine that as a paper map. Not only would it be 10 meters long, say 6 inches of a mile, it would be huge.
Well, you'd also need linear feature records I've read, because they're just like pages and pages and like unconnected photos of like nothing, and you're trying to picture something. You're trying to picture something just from a physical description, which is pointless.
Yeah,
I think this. I don't know. I think it could prove a useful tool for other researchers. The seminar is going to be published, so the paper will end up published in a couple of years' time, and hopefully by then it'll be a bit more developed as a diagram. And I'd love to take this all the way over to Sacramento, but I don't think I can handle doing the western part in California. I think there'd just be too much stuff over there now.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe to Auckland or somewhere. So we'll see.
All right. Well, I think that we're running out of time for this. So, you know, we've gone quite a while, but I like this format. I like to be able to show a slide presentation like this and to have you present this, Stuart. And I will say, there might be another place where you can present this virtually in much the same way, but not on Facebook soon. And I will give you more details on that probably by the end of this week. So,
oh, wait, really?
We're putting something together at the APN to kind of make up for the lack of conferences this year. So,
cool.
But more details on that as we get it planned out. So everybody watch this space, and we'll definitely put an ad for it on a lot of the APN shows so people can hear about it and find out about it. So, I'll mention one last comment that, John just left here just now on the Facebook page. He said, it's weird to hear US 40. He said, I live here in Indiana. He's like, we archaeologists need to work on how we study long linear travel corridors within historic scholarship, rail or road, especially between state lines and different SHPO offices and formats. Because, and I agree with him, because it's like you said, Stuart, you know, studying the Sacramento side. I mean, Reno is downtown Reno is 13 miles from the border of California. So you don't even really start to climb in elevation until you're well into the California side. And it's at least on Interstate 80. You're well into the mountains, but on Interstate 80, you know, it's a little ways in. And I mean, you really have to, most of what you studied there is in fact in the California side. So bringing this all into, you know, across state lines for such a long linear resource is hugely important.
Yeah, I think I'd be interested once it's done, and that is several years away, is to hand it over to the SHPO and other agencies and say, here you go, might be of some use to you.
there you go. And so,
wow, this is
well. Again,
really
thanks a lot, Stuart.
Yeah.
I think Richie and I'll wrap it. Yeah, no worries. I think Richie and I'll wrap it up now. So, if you're watching this video, we had some of Stuart's slide presentation, but we had an issue with the presentation. So, you can check out the slides though at arcpodnet.com/archaeology/90 is the episode number. And for the audio version of this, and if you want to watch the video, you can watch it again here on Facebook. But of course, Richie has some places. Richie, go ahead.
Yeah, you can also watch it on the Man the Hat on Twitch and Happy Archaeology Fun Time on YouTube.
And Richie's been putting out some great videos over on his YouTube channel as well. Go check those out. Some great archaeology stuff, some archaeo tourism type stuff, and some really cool things he's got coming out. So check those out as well.
Cool. Wow.
All
this
right.
This has just been like a, you know, conference presentation, except we're all sober, or at least most of us are sober.
And you couldn't see it.
I know. Well, I think it's better because most conference presentations are 15 to 20 minutes long, and they're probably running long to begin with. In the symposium, you don't have any time because when the symposium's over, there's no time for questions and you got to rush off to another one. So this discussion format for about an hour or so on a single topic has been really great. So,
You're welcome.
A lot of good comments. Yep, Amy says thank you. Member of the APN, just like Chuck is. And anyway, thanks for the people watching too. I'm glad we had some engagement on this. This has been really fantastic.
Oh, one thing I did want to mention is if anyone else wants to present their paper, it's like, you know, I mean, we're always open. I feel like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Contact us. You can reach us through any of this, whatever your source you're watching this on, just message that person and you can comment us. My email address is chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Richie, I don't know if you want to put yours out, but you've got your
it's your FTBVs. I forget my happy archaeology fun time email, but whatever. You can just, it's always in the description of my videos.
You'll find it.
Stuff is there.
Yeah. So
cool.
All right. Well, again, thanks, Stuart. Thanks for coming on. It's a little weird that we had to do this on Zoom because we're all probably within about 3 miles of each other.
I know.
Yeah. That was fun anyway. And thanks for having
me. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. And Richie, I would say, take us out.
Alrighty.
Thanks everybody for watching.
Oh yeah. Oh shoot. I switched this over before where that happened. Perfect. All right. Well, at least we're out on the hang on. Let me get us all off. Let's see. Disable all. Alrighty. So we're no longer transmitting, but we're still live, obviously, on Zoom.
All right. Cool. Yeah. Well, that wasn't too bad. Despite some of the PowerPoint issues, that was really good.
Yeah. And, you know, made it feel more authentic, like I said.
I knew we were done when my drink was mostly empty.
Cool. That was actually really interesting. Like, I'm glad you were here to explain that chart because I was looking at it and I thought I understood it and I feel like I did, but it was still handy having you here explain it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems weird to me that there isn't something already existing like that.
Yeah. I feel like so many people just want to do it the way they've been doing it.
So every other presentation, almost every other presentation, was just someone doing the first half of what I just did, which is telling you about a linear thing and all the things along it. It's like, yeah, well, what are you going to do with this information? how do you process it?
Well, it's the same way we process everything. You know, it just goes into a file and then someone forgets about it.
Well, I wrote a report. So,
Stuart, did you make up that presentation style for that chart, or did you see something similar in another paper?
No, other than these, the ones from London, which are doing something different. No, it's a new format.
Wow, that's really cool because it's a really cool and interesting way to visualize the data that I've never seen before. Really nice.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just keep plugging away at that one and fill it in, but I haven't got access to the California database.
Mm. Yeah.
The California version of Navcrest, so that's a bit of pain in the ass, and I'm stuck using all the local history society's stuff, which is they're wonderful, but they're not. I've got to go talk to some old people. That's what I'm getting at.
I know. Well, it's kind of like the series I've been doing going around Midtown. Like, I wish I could have access to Navcrest because some of this stuff sounds super cool, but I can only have what I have on the internet, and that's not a lot.
Mm. Yeah.
Like right across the street from Coffee Bar. I'm not sure if you've ever seen those white and green buildings or houses. Those apparently were the only examples of prefab buildings in like all of Reno. And apparently they were never very common.
A coffee bar? You mean the Coffee Bar Roastery?
Yeah, no. The regular coffee bar on Mount Rose. Yeah, they're like these white and green houses right across the street from there. And
those.
Yeah, and apparently they used to all be right where the FedEx Kinko's is now, but they moved them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and all the only information I can find is just like what was on this historical website, which wasn't a lot. It was like hardly anything. I really wanted to include them in the video, but I don't feel like 10 seconds of me mentioning something, you know, is worth like going down there and recording, especially since I'd have to set up my camera right outside someone's house, which sounds really weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you looking for the historical forms for these things?
I've
got to know, Chris. If you put a map together, show me the addresses or whatever you want, I can look for forms for you.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Oh, my God. I can totally do that. Expect something in a few days. Cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, my God. God, this was so much fun.
I am learning that trying to extract historic forms from particular addresses in Navcrest is almost impossible once you're in a bloody town.
Oh, wait, really?
No, there's no background mapping, not at any usable scale, so you can't tell where you are. Fucking pain in my ass.
Interesting. Like,
yeah.
Because you know how you zoom in and then it just becomes pixel land?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That'd be a great idea for a CRM archaeology episode, is podcast episode, is like discussing all the issues with all these historical databases and how terrible they are to actually use in real life.
Oh, you could have a big local round table with all the complaints we have about Navcrest, but it wouldn't get you anywhere.
Oh my God.
Yeah. All right. Hey guys, I got to run. I got another podcast to edit for tomorrow morning. So.
Oh, seriously? Wow.
It's one of my clients. Right. Yeah. Her debuts comes out at 5 a.m. So I got to get it done this afternoon.
Oh, wait, is that the realtor?
Yeah. Yeah, she's dropped down to every 2 weeks in this quarantine time, but and I've had 2 weeks to edit it, and I haven't. So there you go. So I got to get it done.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Oh, we should ask her if now is the time to buy a house.
Hey, I've heard now's the time to list your house because people have nothing but time to look at listings on their phone. And when it comes around to it, they'll be ready to buy. So, yeah.
Interesting.
But... yeah. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Like, seriously. Yep.
Thank you, Stuart. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's fun.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.